Chapter 36. There was no feverish hurry after Pitt and Giordino left the burning hovercraft and command post. It seemed reasonable to assume that all communications between the security force and Chin Chang's headquarters were cut off when the plantation burned to the ground. They continued their project of photographing the bed of the canal with the AUV, as if no interruption ever occurred. Neither man was of a mind to do a rushed, botched job. They reached the Atchafalaya River and returned up Hooker's Bayou to the shantyboat just as the eastern sky was beginning to lighten from black to blue-gray. Romberg greeted their arrival by opening his eyes only long enough to recognize them before instantly dropping off into dog dreamland again. Without delay, they unloaded the dive equipment and the AUV. Once the skiff was stowed on the roof, Giordino started the big Ford 427 engine as Pitt pulled the mooring stakes from the mud under the boat. The sun had still to put in an appearance when the shantyboat swung onto the Atchafalaya and headed downriver. "Where to?" Giordino shouted down into the main cabin from the pilot house. "Bartholomew!" Pitt yelled back over the roar of the engine. Giordino said no more. Boat traffic was not as light as he expected this early in the morning. The oyster and crawfish boats were already on the river, heading toward their favored fishing grounds. Towboats with their trains of barges came south after passing through the old river canal lock from the Mississippi into the Atchafalaya north of Baton Rouge. He skirted the other vessels respectfully, but once past, he took the big 427 up to half throttle, sending it barreling down the river at 25 miles an hour. Inside the little house, Pitt sat on a small sofa and played the videotape shot by the cameras of the AUV of the canal bed beginning at the highway bordering the Mississippi and ending at the entrance to the Atchafalaya. From start to finish, the totally dull and boring show ran nearly 6 hours. Except for a few fish, a passing turtle, and a runty baby gator no more than a foot in length, the bottom of the canal was nothing but barren muck. Pitt was relieved to find no bodies, nor was he surprised. Chin Chang's incredibly complicated plan had a small crack in it. The canal was the key, and Pitt was onto its purpose now. But he still found himself on the short side of tangibility. He had no proof. Only a vague theory that even he found almost impossible to accept. He turned off the TV monitor and sat back in the sofa. He didn't dare close his eyes. He could have easily slipped off to sleep. But it wouldn't be fair to Giordino. There was still much to do. He fixed breakfast and called Giordino down to a table laid with a plate of scrambled eggs and ham. He'd brewed coffee in an old-fashioned pot, and set out a carton of orange juice. To save time, he spelled Giordino at the helm while his friend ate. He turned the shanty boat into Berwick Bay, several miles above Morgan City, and traveled south through the Wax Lake Canal, entering Bayou Teche just above Patterson, only 2 miles from the old sugar mill at Bartholomew. He gave the wheel back to Giordino and sat in his lawn chair on the veranda with Romberg curled up beside him. They had made good time, and it was still shy of 12 noon when Giordino slowed the shanty boat as the abandoned sugar mill came into view around a bend just under a mile ahead. Pitt stared through a pair of binoculars, scanning the buildings and the long wharf that trailed along a stone breakwater. A tight smile curled his lips at seeing the barge still loaded with trash. He stood, leaned over the veranda railing, called up to Giordino, and pointed down the bayou. "That must be the place. The barge moored to the wharf looks like the same one we saw at Sungari." Giordino picked up a brass telescope he'd found in a drawer next to the helm. His right eye squinted through the lenses, scanning the wharf and buildings. "The barge is still full. Looks like they haven't gotten around to dumping the trash." Unlike the ramshackle condition of the buildings, the wharf looks no more than a year or two old. Can you make out anyone inside the guard shack by the gate? Giordino swung the telescope and refocused. I have a single security guard sitting on his ass inside watching a TV set. Any sign we might be sailing into an ambush? I've seen cemeteries with more life than this place, Giordino said mildly. Word must not have come down about our party on the canal. I'm going over the side and check out the bottom of the barge, said Pitt. I lost my dive gear at the plantation, so I'll borrow yours. Take it slow, as if you're having engine problems. As soon as I'm in the water, tie up to the wharf and give the guard another of your sterling performances. After mastering the manipulation of unsympathetic audiences, Giordino pontificated, Romberg and I may form an act and go to Hollywood. Don't get your hopes up, Pitt replied sourly. Giordino pulled back the throttle two notches above the idle position and flicked the ignition key on and off to simulate misfiring cylinders within the engine. As soon as he saw Pitt in his wetsuit stepping over the catwalk on the side of the shantyboat out of sight of the guard, he turned the wheel toward the wharf. A few seconds later, when he glanced downward, Pitt was gone. He watched Pitt's bubbles approach the barge, and then steadily scatter as he passed under its bottom edge. It looked to Giordino as if Pitt was working deeper and deeper. Then the bubbles rising beside the barge disappeared altogether. Giordino slowly raised a hand to shield the sun from his eyes and expertly steered the shantyboat around the barge and along the pilings without scratching the paint on the hull. Then he dropped down a ladder to the catwalk, jumped onto the wharf, and began looping mooring lines around a pair of rusty bollards. The guard came out of his shack, unlocked the gate, and rushed up to the shantyboat. He cautiously eyed Romberg, who acted happy to see him. The guard looked Asian, but he spoke with a West Coast accent. He was a good 4 inches taller than Giordino, but much thinner. He wore a baseball cap and World War II pilot sunglasses. You must leave. This is a private dock. The owners do not allow boats to moor here.
I can't help it, Giordino moaned. My engine died on me. Just give me 20 minutes and I'll have it fixed.
The guard was not to be refused. He began untying the lines. You must leave. Giordino walked over and grasped the guard's wrist in an iron grip. Chin Shang will not be happy when I report your offensive behavior to one of his inspectors. The guard looked at Giordino queerly. Chin Shang? Who the hell is Chin Shang? I was hired by the Butterfield Freight Corporation. Now it was Giordino's turn to make a queer expression. He unconsciously glanced over the side into the water, where he'd last seen Pitt's air bubbles, and wondered if they'd made a big mistake. You were hired to do what? Keep crows off the corn? No, said the guard defensively, unable to shake Giordino's grip, and contemplating whether he was dealing with a madman and should draw his holstered revolver. Butterfield uses the old buildings to store furniture and equipment from their offices around the country. My job and the guards who work the other shifts is to keep vandals off the property. Giordino released the guard's arm. He was far too wise and cynical to fall for the lie. He was almost thrown off the track in the first moments of the conversation. But now he knew with solid conviction there was more to the abandoned sugar mill at Bartholomew than met the eye. Tell me, friend, would it be worth a bottle of Black Label Jack Daniel's whiskey to let me stay here just long enough to fix my engine? I don't think so, the guard said testily as he rubbed his wrist. Giordino fell back into his backcountry accent.
Look, I'm in a bind. If I just drift out in the river while working down on the engine, I could be busted in two by a towboat.
That's not my problem.
Two bottles of Black Label Jack Daniel's whiskey?
A sly look gleamed in the guard's eyes. Four bottles. Giordino stuck out his hand.
Done.
Then he motioned through the door leading inside the shantyboat from the veranda.
Come on board and I'll put 'em in a sack for you.
The guard looked apprehensively at Romberg. Does he bite?
Only if you put your hand in his mouth and step on his jaws. Unwittingly drawn into the web, the guard stepped around Romberg and entered the shantyboat's main cabin. It was the last thing he remembered until he woke up 4 hours later. Giordino hit him on the nape of the neck. Not a judo chop, but a huge fist swung like a club that sent the guard crashing heavily to the deck. Out for the long count. 10 minutes later, Giordino, wearing the guard's uniform, pants and sleeves too long by inches, but the shirt straining at its buttons as his chest and shoulders stretched the seams, stepped out on the shantyboat's veranda. With the guard's baseball cap pulled down over the old, wide-style sunglasses, Giordino leisurely walked to the gate, closed it behind him, and pretended to lock it. Then he went inside the guard shack and sat in front of the television set while his eyes roamed the grounds of the sugar mill, picking out the security cameras placed about the property. Pitt sank to the bottom before swimming up and under the flat bottom of the barge. He was surprised to encounter the bed of the bayou at 30 feet beside the wharf, far deeper than was necessary for barge traffic. The depth must have been dredged to accept a deep-hulled ship. It was as if a cloud had passed over the sun. The shadow of the barge cut off nearly 50% of the light from the surface. The water was an opaque green and filled with plant particles. He swam fast and had hardly passed under the barge when a vague shape appeared in the gloom and stopped his progress. Hanging from the keel of the barge was an immense cylindrical tube with tapered ends. Pitt instantly recognized what it was, and his heart began to pump faster with excitement. The size and regular shape was similar to the hull of an early submarine. He swam along the hull slightly above it. There were no visible ports, and he could see that it was attached to the barge by a system of rails. These, Pitt immediately determined, were used to move the submerged container from the seagoing ship to the barge and back again. He estimated the size of the underwater container at 90 feet in length by nearly 15 feet in diameter by 10 feet high. Without being able to peer inside, Pitt quickly realized that it was capable of housing anywhere from 200 to 400 people, depending on how tightly they were packed inside. Quickly, he swam around the vessel to the other side, looking for a hatch connecting with an underwater passage from the vessel to inside the breakwater that anchored the wharf. He found it 30 feet aft of the bow, a small watertight tunnel just large enough for two people to pass through at the same time. Pitt could find no way to enter, certainly not from the water. He was about to give up and swim back to the shanty boat when he spotted a small round portal embedded in the stone breakwater. The portal was above the surface of the water, but just below the planking on the wharf. It was covered by an iron door that was secured by 3 dog levers. Its purpose eluded him. A sewer outlet? A drainage pipe? A maintenance tunnel? A closer inspection of the lettering stamped by the manufacturer on the iron door cleared up the mystery. Manufactured by the Acadia Chute Company, New Orleans, Louisiana. It was a chute that was used when the mill was in operation to load the raw sugar onto barges. The old wharf had been demolished and a new one constructed that was 5 feet higher to accommodate the passage of illegal immigrants under the water without being visible on the surface. The newer, raised wharf now sat a good foot over the early loading chute. The dog levers were badly rusted and probably hadn't been opened in 80 years. But the bayou water did not have the salt content of the sea. The corrosion was not deep. Pitt gripped a dog lever with both hands, positioned his feet against the upper planks of the wharf, and pulled downward. To his delight, the lever gave and moved an inch on the first try. The next heave took it 3 inches. Then it turned more easily. Finally, he twisted it out against its stop. The second dog lever came slightly easier, but the third fought him every inch of the way.
Gasping and panting, Pitt rested for a minute before pulling the door open. It fought too. He had to put both feet against the breakwater and pull with every ounce of strength he had left. At last the iron door grudgingly squeaked open on its rusting hinges. Pitt peered inside, but all he could see was darkness. He turned and swam under the wharf, stopping just before he reached the shantyboat's hull. He called up softly, "Al, are you there?" His only response came from Romberg. Curious, the hound strolled onto the wharf and sniffed through the cracks in the planking just above Pitt's head. "Not you. I want Giordino." Romberg began wagging his tail. He stretched out his front paws and lay down on the wharf and playfully tried to dig through the wooden planking. Inside the guard shack, Giordino turned every minute or two and stared at the shantyboat for an indication of Pitt's return. Seeing Romberg pawing and scratching on the wharf for something underneath made him curious. He slowly walked through the gate and stopped by the dog. "What are you sniffing at?" he asked.
"Me,"
Pitt whispered through the planking. "Geez," muttered Giordino. "For a second I thought Romberg could talk." Pitt stared up between the cracks in the planks.
"Where did you get the uniform?"
"The guard decided to take a nap, and charitable, benevolent fellow that I am, I offered to stand his watch. Even with my limited view, I can tell it's a lousy fit."
"You might be interested to learn," said Giordino, facing away from the sugar mill and rubbing a 2-day whiskered chin to cover his lip movements. "This place is owned by the Butterfield Freight Corporation, not Chinchang Maritime. Also, the guard may have Asian ancestry, but I figure he went to school in either L.A. or San Francisco."
"Butterfield has to be a corporate front used by Shang to move people in and out of here. There's a submerged vehicle connected to the bottom of the barge that has the capacity to transport close to 400 bodies."
"Then we've found the mother load."
"We'll know shortly. Just as soon as I get inside."
"How?"
asked Giordino simply.
"I found a chute that was used to load sugar onto barges. It appears to lead toward the main building."
"Watch your step and make it fast.
I don't know how much longer I can fool whoever is monitoring me."
"They have a camera on you?" asked Pitt.
"I've counted 3 and suspect there may be a few more around the perimeter I haven't spotted yet," Giordino answered.
"Can you drop my .45 over the side? I don't want to go in naked."
"I'll lower it over the side."
"You're okay, Al. I don't care what they say about you," said Pitt.
"If I hear a gunshot," said Giordino as he walked toward the shantyboat, "Romberg and I will come running."
"That should be a sight to behold."
Giordino entered the shantyboat, took Pitt's Colt automatic, and shiftily lowered it on a string through a window until it hung just above the water surface opposite the wharf. He felt a sharp tug on the line, and the gun was gone. Then he slowly made his way back to the guard shack, where he unholstered the impressive Wesson Firearms .357 Magnum revolver that he'd taken off the unconscious guard, and waited for something to happen. Pitt dropped his air tank, weight belt, and the rest of the dive gear below the shantyboat. Clad only in his wetsuit and carrying the Colt above his head to keep it dry, he stroked under the wharf to the chute portal and climbed inside. It was a tight squeeze, and he had to pull his body along a few inches at a time. The Colt he slipped under the collar of his wetsuit against his upper chest, making it easy merely to bend his arm and retrieve it should an unpleasant occasion arise. The light decreased the farther he penetrated the chute, his body blocking off a fair share of it. But he could still see well enough to pick out any obstacles that lay ahead. He fervently hoped he wouldn't run up against a poisonous snake. With almost no room to maneuver, he would either have to club it to death with the old Colt or shoot it. One event risked a bite from fangs, the other detection by security guards. Then a belated fear flooded his mind.
What if the other end was blocked by another iron door that could only be opened from the opposite side? There was no denying the possibility. But the gamble was worth the effort, he rationalized. Nothing ventured and all that. He forged on until the chute began to slope upward. The going became more difficult as gravity began to work against him. Fingertips scraped raw from clawing the corroded lining of the chute. Pitt continued forward. A vivid imagination could have easily conjured up visions of nightmare monsters from an alien world lurking in the darkness ahead. But reality revealed an empty, hollow chute, nothing more. Slowly, almost imperceptibly, the chute began to widen, as if blossoming into the upper half of a giant funnel. Then, suddenly and completely unanticipatedly, he found himself crawling into a large bin that flared upward and out to the sides. The upper lip was only 4 feet away. He struggled upward, gaining a grip and pulling himself higher, then climbing toward the upper rim of the chute. Automatic grasped in one hand and only dimly aware of the curious prickling sensation moving up the nape of his neck, he heard voices drifting into the chute, voices that were not speaking English. He also became strongly aware of the heavy, sickening odor of human bodies packed too long in a stifling atmosphere. Pitt raised his head until his eyes could see over the edge of the chute. He found himself gazing down from a height of 12 feet into a large chamber scarcely lit by a small, dirty skylight in the ceiling. The walls of the chamber were dingy brick, the floor concrete. Standing, lying, or crouched in the stale atmosphere of the chamber, packed together shoulder to shoulder with little or no room to move about, were over 300 men, women, and children in varying states of sickness, malnutrition, and fatigue. All appeared to be Chinese. Pitt scanned the chamber but saw no guards. The mass of humanity below was sealed in what was once the sugar processing room. The only entrance was barred by a thick wooden door. As he watched, the door abruptly swung open, and an Asian wearing the same uniform Giordino had taken off the guard at the dock roughly pushed a man into the crowded chamber. A woman, who Pitt assumed was the man's wife, had her arms tightly pinned by another guard in a passage outside. The door slammed shut with an echoing thud, and the man, in a highly emotional state, pounded on it and cried out in Chinese, clearly begging the guards not to take the woman away. Without misgivings or thoughts of personal risk, Pitt dropped out of the chute opening onto the floor below, landing on his feet between two women, knocking both into people packed around them, creating a ripple in the mass. The women stared at him in startled curiosity, but said nothing. No one else gave indication of his sudden appearance. Pitt didn't bother to beg their pardon. He moved quickly through the huddled crowd of bodies toward the door. Reaching it, he gently pushed the sobbing man aside and then rapped on the door with the butt of his Colt. It was a familiar knock, one long, four short, two long, often given by someone friendly with the occupants on the other side. After the second try, Pitt's brazenness was rewarded. As he'd hoped, the guard's curiosity was aroused by the incomprehensible rap instead of the crazed pounding from a distraught husband. The lock clacked, and the door was thrown open again, only this time with Pitt standing behind it. A guard burst back into the chamber, grabbing the husband by the collar and shaking him like a fruit tree. The other guard still stood in the passage, pinning the woman's arms cruelly behind her back. He spoke angrily in perfect English.
"Tell that dumb bastard for the last time he isn't getting his wife back until he forks over another $10,000.
Pitt's arm whirled in a blurred arc downward, the butt of the Colt in his hand connecting solidly on the side of the first guard's head, sending him unconscious to the concrete floor. Then Pitt stepped into the open doorway, gun pointed steadily at the head of the man with the young woman. "I don't mean to intrude, but I believe you have something that belongs to someone else." The guard's jaw, already open at seeing his colleague crumpled in a heap, dead to the world, began working furiously as he stared pop-eyed at the apparition in the black wetsuit.
"Who the hell are you?"
"I was hired by your captives to act as their agent," Pitt said, smiling. "Now let the girl go." The guard had guts, Pitt had to admit that. One arm moved up and encircled the young woman's neck.
"Drop the gun, or by God, I'll snap her neck."
Pitt stepped forward and raised the Colt until the muzzle was only a few inches from the guard's left eye. "I'll blow your eyes out if you do. Is that what you want, to spend the rest of your days as a blind man?" The guard was smart enough to know he was in a no-win situation. He looked up and down the passageway in hope of finding help. But he was alone. Slowly, he acted as if his hold was loosening around the woman's neck, while his other hand inched toward a gun in a holster at his hip. Pitt caught the movement and rammed the muzzle of the Colt into the guard's eye. "Not a wise gamble, my friend." He smiled pleasantly, his teeth gleaming in the pale light. The guard gasped in pain, dropped his hold on the woman, and clutched both hands to his eye.
"Oh, God, you blinded me!"
"No such luck," Pitt said briefly, as he yanked the guard into the chamber by the collar. He didn't have to order the woman. She had already rushed by him and thrown herself into her husband's arms. The worst you can expect is a bloodshot eyeball for a few days. Pitt kicked the big door closed, crouched down, and hurriedly removed the guard's revolvers from their holsters. Then he searched them for concealed weapons. The guard he'd knocked unconscious carried a small .32-caliber automatic strapped to his pants belt behind his back. The other had a Bowie knife stuffed in one boot. Then he checked them for size to see which one came closest in height and weight. They were both considerably shorter, but one nearly matched his chest and waist measurements. As he began to switch clothes, Pitt spoke to the hushed horde, who stared back at him as if he was some kind of deity. "Do any of you speak English?" Two people made their way toward him. One was an elderly man with a long white beard, the other an attractive woman in her mid-30s.
"My father and I can speak English," she said. "We both taught languages at Chungking University."
Pitt swept his hand around the chamber. "Please tell them to bind and gag these men and hide their bodies as far away from the door as possible, where they can't be easily found." The father and daughter nodded.
"We understand," he replied. "We will also caution them to remain quiet."
"Thank you," said Pitt, as he stripped off his wetsuit. "Am I correct in saying that you have all been treated badly by the smugglers who are extorting you for more money?"
"Yes," answered the woman. "All you say is true. We were subjected to unspeakable conditions during the voyage from China. After we arrived in the United States, we were brought here by the enforcers from Xinchang Maritime, where we were turned over to an American-Chinese crime syndicate. It is they who are extorting us for more money by threatening to either kill or force us into indentured slavery if we do not pay."
"Tell them all to take heart," said Pitt solemnly. "Help is on the way." He finished dressing, grinning when he noticed that a good 3 inches of socks showed between the guard's shoes, two sizes too small, and the bottom cuffs of the trousers. While the guards were dragged to the other end of the chamber and bound, Pitt slipped one revolver and the Colt automatic inside his pants and buttoned the shirt over them. Next, he adjusted the holster containing the second guard's revolver at his side. Then, with a quick look of encouragement to the poor wretched immigrants, he stepped into the passage, quietly closed the door, and locked it. 20 feet to the left of the door, the passage ended in a tangled mass of old rusty machinery that filled it from floor to ceiling. Pitt went right and came to a stairway ascending to a corridor that opened onto a series of rooms with huge copper pots that had corroded over the decades until the once bright metal had changed to a patinated green. Pitt entered one of what had been the sugar cane cooking rooms and peered through a long row of dusty windows. Below him was a vast storage and shipping terminal. A pair of railroad tracks ran between two loading docks before stopping at a concrete barrier. Broad doors on one end of the floor were spread open to accommodate three freight cars that were being backed down a slope by a diesel-electric locomotive painted in the blue and orange colors of the Louisiana and Southern Railroad. Next to the building near the railroad tracks, Pitt could see a parked pair of white stretch limousines, their drivers talking together while watching with interest as the train rolled past. It became startlingly clear to Pitt that the immigrants he'd just left were about to be loaded on the freight cars. Accompanied by a growing knot in his stomach, he also observed that the loading docks were manned by nearly a dozen guards. After seeing all there was to see, he sat down below the window, back to the wall, and considered the situation. Stopping the smugglers from boarding the immigrants onto the train looked grim. Stalling them was a tactic that lay open. But what good would delaying the inevitable do? He might take out four or five of the guards before they recovered from surprise and blasted him. But where were the percentages in that? There was almost no hope of terminating the departure, but there was a slim chance of bringing it to a standstill, at least for the next few hours. Pitt removed his small arsenal and studied the two .357 Magnum revolvers, the Bowie knife, and his steadfast old Colt. The six-shot revolvers gave him 12 rounds. Many years ago, he had redesigned the grip on the Colt to hold a 12-shot magazine. The revolvers were loaded with hollow-point cartridges, excellent for stopping power and producing extreme tissue damage in man and animal, but not efficient for what Pitt had in mind. His .45 packed Winchester 185-grain silver tips, which were not as brutal on flesh, but had better penetration. He had 24 chances to stop the train's departure. Only one lucky shot would do it. The problem was that although he had more than enough killing power, he was woefully short in the metal-piercing department. His intent was to strike a vital part of the diesel engines and electric generators, shutting down all power to the drive wheels. Pitt sighed, rose to his knees, took the revolvers in both hands, and commenced firing, aiming at the louvered sides of the locomotive.